feel time is a major factor to the story because Norma has changed it. My personal story can only be what I experienced. It wasn't as abusive as it makes it sound. But again, the other layer to it is I was coming from much more abusive kitchens. So again, me telling it wasn't abusive doesn't mean there was nothing happening. Unfortunately, in the industry, what's happening is we give the most value to the people who serve the least people with the most amount of money. That's what is causing this problem of imbalance where food companies don't even need to think of employing chefs. I've always chosen the option, which I do not. If I do not choose it, I'll regret the most. You might go wrong, but at least you were in the driving seat and not being driven by somebody else in the car.
HospitalityChain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, HospitalityChain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save. All in one global marketplace. Chef, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to come on the podcast today. And the biggest burning question, because of your background, is what are your thoughts on Noma, man? Because that's been the rave. That's the talk right now. And you literally lived it and saw it in its prime.
Yeah, I mean, I've got this question for the past few weeks, what's been going on. I mean, I've spoken to Jason White personally as well over Instagram because we shared the same space. We were working together because a lot of stories coming out of our people who have been at Noma at different points of time. And I feel time is a major factor to the story because Noma has changed itself. So as you pick up a slice, you'll feel, okay, this version or this account of things doesn't match the other person's story. So with Jason, the thing is, Jason was, working in 2022 when I was there as well. And my personal, I walked there as an intern. First of all, I entered there for a 1 month internship. My idea was to intern because I was working at Mugaritz, and Mugaritz is a restaurant which closes for R&D. Is the one of the only places which does that. It works 8 months a year, 4 months it shuts. And during that shut period, I was saying, okay, I'll try some other kitchen. And it ended up being that the second week in Noma, they offered me a contract. They said, okay, if you want, we have a place for you. And that was not what I had expected because, I mean, they have tons of interns on their doors, literally, which also is a layer of why the environment is the way it is. And a lot of what Jason says is true. There are true stories behind it. My personal story can only be what I experienced. So I didn't experience the amount of abuse that Jason says. There's a lot of claims coming out of the stories of people whose stories Jason's using ends up being that these people do not relate with that story anymore. So there's so much confusion. So which is why I've said no to many interviews on the topic. But my personal vision, as I've put on my Instagram as well, that my own accounts, it wasn't as abusive as it makes it sound. But again, the other layer to it is I was coming from much more abusive kitchens. So again, me telling it wasn't abusive doesn't mean there was nothing happening. There were a lot of signs of what Jason says, a lot of people riding on egos, people riding on a lot of attitude, a lot of bad energy, not possibly the best sort of language. But at the same time, for me, it was a place that if I just see my personal story of how it went, I had to leave it at the end of almost completing a year in Noma, and I had to leave because there was immigration problems all over Denmark, and especially as somebody who's a third country national who's not European, in my case I'm from India, Ukraine war happened in 2022 and Denmark suddenly started prioritizing, and all European countries honestly started prioritizing Ukrainian asylum seekers, refugees or immigrants. So all of our, like, the non-Europeans, their visas went on hold. So there was a lot of uncertainty. So I said this to Rene Thomas, the administration, Kenneth, the head chef at the time. And they said, you know what? We are going to go to Japan. That was the reality at that point. They were moving to Japan in 2023. The restaurant was supposed to be shut, as we see. It is not right now. So they said, actually, it won't be worth the risk if you just risk being here right now and you suddenly end up not getting the residence permit, which I was in process of. So I said, you know what, maybe you should see other options. And I said, okay, going back to Spain makes the most sense. So they went out of the way and they paid me 2 months of salary, saying that, you know, you're figuring out yourself. You're not working with us right now. That's okay. You can go back, see what's left for you in Spain. And I'm honestly very thankful that I made that move, which is why I'm where I am today. But they supported me financially, which was not asked for, not required. The other layer to this is this was happening at the same time as Financial Times article came out in 2022. So was that because they had good intentions? Was that because they were scared of more things coming out if they don't do these measures that they were doing with me? So again, there's so many layers to it, honestly, Jeff, that I feel my personal account, to be very specific, was not the kind of abuse that you're seeing on Instagram. And it has positively affected my career. Even today, when I walk into kitchens working at Heinz, which has nothing to do with fine dining, even there, I feel the things I'm applying in today's world of what I work in R&D is a lot of learning coming from environments like Noma and Mugaritz, where we did a lot of research, but at a lot of cost, at a lot of different timelines, different scales. So that experience has helped me to be where I am today. So it feels unfair to say that the abuse was the only part of it that I've carried forward. I hope that answers your question. It's a little
No, it does. Because it's always interesting to hear someone that's in it, right? Because there's always, you know, there's always three sides of the story, right? Their side, your side, and then the truth. But the truth is each individual accounts of the truth. You know what I mean? Because even if somebody sees something as abusive or a little rough, others might find that as motivating, right?
Yeah.
To a level of like, I need someone almost military style, right? Get your ass kicked, you know, get you in shape, get you ready. And others maybe aren't cut out for that. So again, not that anything's right or wrong. I really wanted to hear what your kind of perspective was on with your time there. And it's great that you clarified that, you know, you actually came out of it positively. Mm-hmm. Through the whole experience, because I never went through that fine dining experience. I've said it multiple times. Mm-hmm. That wasn't my upbringing. So I always have a very high interest with people who lived in that space, did that space for quite some time, because I can't relate to it. So I vicariously live through those that I talk to, other chef friends that are in the industry, and they're like, yeah, it was this way, it was that way, and try to assemble it and piece it together in my own way. I came from more of like where you're at now, not mm-hmm. so much of doing R&D, but in the corporate world side of things. And obviously we're gonna dig into that and how you got there. You know, maybe let's backtrack how you know you're in the Netherlands now, correct?
Yes, that's where
yeah,
I am.
Yeah. How do you navigate? You know, you went to CIA. You went CIA, correct?
No. I honestly have not taken any formal education when it comes to culinary arts.
You did nothing.
No, I've done hotel management, and that's funnily enough what everybody in India, at least when I was growing up, was doing, which is also funny because at that point there was no culinary arts program. This is 2015, 14. And what was there is that, I mean, there's of course chefs and there's of course restaurants in India. But the thing is that all the good restaurants exist in hotels, which is the complete opposite of Europe. You do not go for good food to restaurants which are in hotels. So it's the opposite of how India works. I think it's because the kind of people who can afford good food possibly are visitors or travelers who are staying in these hotels, these five-star properties. So the restaurants are inside that. So you basically, if you want to be a chef, you need to study hotel management. Because the way a chef works in a standalone restaurant is very different from what a hotel chef works like. So that's the only education of culinary I got is from hotel management.
Wow, that's interesting. Because you wanted to do baking and pastry, but realized that wasn't really your thing. So how did you practice that or do that and then actually realize, okay, hell no, I don't want to have everything exactly perfect all the time?
Yeah, I think, I mean, through this program, the thing with hotel management is you, of course, learn front office, housekeeping, all the layers of hotels. I learn how to do hotel engineering, how the water gets to a certain room, for example, accountancy. But we also had 8 hours of culinary plus like 4 hours of culinary, like the savory side of food. And we also had like 4 hours of baking pastry. And in this initial exposure, because again, Indian education is very much still bent towards the French kind of classical cuisine in the first year. And I already got exposure of what life could look like because I had, of course, faculty who was teaching, who has been in the industry. There were people who had been on all scale of baking, confectionery, pastry in restaurants, pastry, standalone pastry places. And what I understood very early is that my sort of creativity, which is very chaotic, I think it comes from having ADHD. It's like you feel you're creative, but you're in all directions at sorts. I felt that it doesn't really match very well with. And I think now is when I actually calculate and think that's what I thought. But in the moment, it felt very uncomfortable. I think I felt this discomfort of having to depend on an oven, having to depend on like gadgets and methods and techniques and machines and precision. And I feel I'm not the most precise person, which is why I have had my hands in a lot of careers and a lot of different kitchens. And I said, the only way I can progress is by capitalizing that chaos rather than going against it. And I feel being in baking and pastry would have been completely going against how I am. So I feel in a hot side of savory kitchen, you can think like you can literally put things in a pot and just keep throwing it in and adjust it to fairly have a good end product. Whereas in baking and pastry, there's very little you can do until you reach a stage where you actually understand how the science behind works and you can make your own chocolates and make your own temperatures and play around. But I, at that point, starting on, I felt like it's going to be too much of control, and I feel I thrive when there is no control around me.
On the outside looking in, with what you're doing as an R&D chef, it almost sounds counterintuitive. Because
exactly.
You think, okay, R&D, things are precise. You're doing this, you're doing that, you're scaling. Mm-hmm. How does that play into what you do today as an R&D chef? And how do you bridge the gap, right? You're mm-hmm. you're a chef, but there's scientists, there's people who went to school, people who didn't go to school. How does that all work together?
Yes, I mean, right now I'm very fresh in this role. I've started 2 months ago as the senior innovation chef at Kraft Heinz. They approached me towards the beginning of last year. I was not interested. Then we had some chats and it seemed like it's the right progression. So I'm still very fresh in this role and still navigating currently my day-to-day for somebody who's listening, because I think many listeners could also wonder, you know, what is a chef doing inside a food company which makes basically ketchup and a Miracle Whip and things like that, Lunchables. So my role is I'm the head of everything apart from North America. So how Heinz works is we have an R&D in North America, and then we have the rest of the world. So I am the head of tomato ketchup when it comes to it. So right now my job is more into like the ketchup formulation, or how ketchup works won't change much. There will be like maybe people want lesser salt, sugar. We have some variants with dietary problems and things like that. But it's more about picturing the, like imagining the future of how do people still eat ketchup when they don't eat that many fries as they used to. So things like this, even though it doesn't feel very obvious that a chef would be required in these roles, what you have to think is that all the sauces, say just picking up Heinz, all the sauces that a person eats, nobody's opening a sachet of sauce and putting them in the mouth. They're eating that with something. So if you think about sauces, for example, nobody's opening the sachet and putting it in their mouth and just drinking the sauce by itself. Whereas if you look at a food company, mostly they're testing these products in isolation. And what the food companies have realized lately is why people like me exist in these companies is because they don't need... I mean, when you ask about like, if I do not like precision, if I do not like calculation, why am I inside? So, of course, a part of my job is calculating so that what I create can be replicated. So with that part, I have grown affinity and grown into like liking that part of it. But again, they have people who are more into, say, program when it comes to the sales side of things, the marketing side of things, the microbiology or the physiochemical part of it, how a texture can be measured on a texturometer. So they have people on those side of things. What they need me is kind of to push those boundaries of like imagining, okay, burger, fries, ketchup. I think it's only because of people like me, and there are those like me who are in the team. We are 10 people in the culinary team. It's people like us who push the boundary of where this product can go. And that's how my character comes inside. I feel they are kind of capitalizing this hedonist culinary view that comes from fine dining. And actually before this role, the 4 years I was with Bas Culinary Center, that was a different role altogether, because there I was doing, say, the first ideation version of these food companies. I was working for like Givaudan or like Old El Paso, all these food companies, creating the future scenarios from them. So what could snacking look like in 10 years? So reports like this, food companies use to kind of program, okay, if these chefs think this is where snacking is going to go, because fine dining sets the paradigm for a lot of things we see in consumer goods. So that is where they needed me. So for documenting or the side of things that chefs don't like much, which is documenting or recording what they're doing so it can be replicated, we had people for that. We had sensory scientists. So when I was last year, I was traveling Jamaica, Korea, India, Mexico, and Nigeria and China, tracking what spicy food is. So again, as a chef, I'm the right person to judge how Mexican spicy is different from Indian spicy, because I was born in India and because I understand how Mexican food works. I see the steps, but they still need somebody who can boil this down into terms which are not ambiguous, which are not very specific to a person. So they had a sensory scientist tracking this down. And that's how I feel these environments balance this energy of a chef and a scientist.
Oh, that's super cool. You know, many people are stepping away from the past, you know, and viewing that as a loss of identity. You know, how is your personal definition of what it means to be a chef changed since you started working in food innovation?
So honestly, when I ended up like, actually your podcast name is Fell Into Food, and I feel my story of every transition has been falling into it, honestly. From starting off at the first restaurant I ever worked at in Europe, it's called Noor. I wrote this guy, honestly, if anybody who's listening, look this restaurant up. It's one of the few 3 Michelin star restaurants, started when I was back there, 2017. It was a 1 Michelin star place, 7 months open. And he does food from when Spain, or Cordoba specifically, the south of Spain, was a part of the Arab Empire. So he cooks without tomato, without chilies, without corn, without garlic, all the things that Columbus bought with him. is not in his cuisine. So actually what I'm saying is that I wrote to him that, hey, I want to be, I'm doing a research about ancient cuisines. Could you write me a letter for my research? He didn't understand an English email and said, you know what, if you want to come intern with me, you can come intern. So that's how I fell into that job. And then your question about like how did I end up into this field, and how does being a chef feel inside these environments? I honestly, when I was looking off like what next after Noma, when I had to leave Noma because of this immigration issues, I said, I was like, okay, I can either go back to working at kitchens. Of course, there are more kitchens where I could learn, keep learning and keep going with that. But I said, it's actually a good moment because I do not really know what I want to do right now. I have this 2 months of salary these guys are going to pay. So what else can I do if I don't want to work in a restaurant setup? So I wanted to push myself out of it. But I honestly missed examples. I did not know. I mean, in my head, I think when I look 6-7 years back now, I had no idea that there are chefs inside catering. There's chefs inside airlines. Like subconsciously, you know there's people behind this. But you don't really think in these packaged foods or people studying about ethnography or why Thai cuisine is where it is right now. They have chefs working with the government, creating a gastrodiplomacy program. So I did not have the vision of these things. And which is why I ended up creating a platform called Fugitive Chefs to kind of track these stories of what are chefs doing when they leave this career of being chef, which is very guest facing. So today for me, I think chef, to your question of like, how do I still feel, or do I even feel I'm a chef anymore because I'm not having clients serving every evening and having their like quick feedback of how they find the food. I feel, as on my podcast, Dan Giusti, who's also from the States, he mentioned that unfortunately in the industry, what's happening is we give the most value to the people who serve the least people with the most amount of money. And that's what's happening, because we are putting fine dining chefs, especially in this place where they decide what a chef is or not. And I feel that's what is causing this problem of imbalance, where food companies don't even need to think of employing chefs. I mean, Kraft Heinz and the Unilevers and the big ones are a comfortable position where they can do that. But many food companies don't even look at chefs. They look at food technologists or profiles like those, because they feel that's enough and that's got them the flavor part covered. If you have a flavor scientist, we have the flavor part covered. If we have a microbiologist, we've got the fermentation part covered. So unfortunately, they don't look at chefs, and that's what I'm trying to push. What I'm trying to push is people like me who are possibly not serving guests, but everybody having a ketchup in their fridge has me behind that vision of a product. So I feel we need to give more importance and put chefs in these roles, because I feel still of these food companies, the chef side of things, the culinary side of things, is still the most human side of things, which cannot be replaced by an AI agent or a bot. We are helped by these tools, yes, but we still need this human side of how flavor can evolve, what is right, what is wrong, this moral compass. And that's why I feel, to your question, I feel yes, I do feel comfortable. It took me time to realize that, okay, this can be a job where I still feel a chef. But I feel at the point where I am right now, I think the contribution of chefs like me is much higher when you look at scales of consumption of food in general.
Man, you put that really well. That term, right? It's so overused, I don't even know how to explain it, right? But when you say that word, the first thing comes to mind is fine dining, white coat. And to your point, they feed the least amount of people that have the most amount of money. And there's so many chefs in this industry. To your point, there's R&D, what you do. There's contract management. That's what I was in, managing large teams, feeding lots of people. And to me, that term has always been about leadership, more so than just you can cook really good food, because there are guys that could cook the pants off of what I can do on a regular basis. But that doesn't mean I don't give up that term and say, oh, I'm not a chef anymore. I feel like once you've earned it in the proper way, that's something you get to keep with you, and not overuse it. You know, I'd let people, you want to call me chef? Great. If you don't, I don't really care, right? It's not my identity of who I am.
Exactly.
That just happens to be a position that I did, and I carry it through me so people understand that. Because I was one of those guys that thought I needed to go back and get a food science degree, to be honest. I was thinking about, you know, I was working in kitchens and I was like, man, I really want to get into like R&D and the sciencey stuff. I hated school. I'm good at like the writing the papers, just getting stuff done, but the physical, just like being in a school environment, like I feel like I'm in a cage, to your point. Like I can't just do what I want to do. So what specific like real world skills did you lean on to prove that you could do these kind of jobs?
So I would say, first of all, I completely relate with this feeling of like knowing that maybe you're not the right person. Or maybe, because many of the times I feel with me and others in the community that I'm mentoring of students or young chefs who are transitioning into these jobs, I feel a lot of the times we question ourselves before the employer is. So the employer knows exactly what they're looking for. They know they're looking for a chef who can apply this food into a certain context or culture or whatever that is. But we start questioning. So that's very normal, I feel, first of all, to confirm your point. So I did feel that in the first, I think the first few years at Basque Culinary Center, I said, before I knew what the job is, so I'm still getting like onboarded into the company, understanding the terms. I feel a lot of it is language. I think that's one thing which no school can teach you, because the language of, I mean, just, yeah, the acronyms they use, the words they use, or the methodologies they use. I feel, first of all, I thought the getting a school or getting a degree, because this, most of these companies also have budgets to be able to educate you or give you time to do an online program or not go full-time into studying, but you can still get kind of, first of all, I would say people should look at that, because most companies can let you study alongside your job. So I looked at those options. But the more and more I started getting into understanding, okay, what will this program actually teach? It wasn't matching my reality. So, of course, there are programs which teach you about food technology. So they will teach you what is statistics, like how can you kind of calculate a scale of product, or how can you check the pH of something, or how can you use these machines. But I feel the more I was there and consulting people who have been into this job, so what helped me the most is seeing others who had not gone through the traditional path. So, of course, at every environment, you'll see those who have got the food science part. But luckily, at Basque Culinary Center, I had good mentors and examples who had not gone through the path. So, first of all, that confirmed me, okay, maybe I can get by without for now. Maybe I'll see in 2 years if I need this. And ultimately, as I kept growing and as I kept seeing the value I bring to the team, I started realizing, honestly, I do not need the degrees I thought I needed, because the way I was working, I was in a culinary team, which is possibly, say, let's take an example so people understand. So if we are doing a project which is about taking the waste from, say, apple juice, taking apple juice waste, constructing a dish, a beverage out of it, which is a functional beverage. So in all of these parts of the project, you would think as a chef, you would need to know the food science of the fermentation part, or possibly what enzymes have to be used to break down this waste and things like that. Yes, you need that. So, but I feel in today's day and age, I mean, I'm talking about right now. I mean, I did this 4 years ago, but right now, even so more, all of this information is available. Believe me, you can have all of the information of how to get somewhere easily, however scientific that is. Plus, in my job, I had a microbiologist, so who's a PhD in that. So no point in me doing a food science degree will beat her skills. So why not, rather than trying to beat her skills or trying to be able to beat my insecurity more than her skills, why can I not just go with what I know, ask the right questions, the people who are available in these environments, and just build upon that? And that's what I did. And honestly, that's worked for me so far.
Wow. Incredible. And you mentioned the Fugitive Chefs podcast. That's the space that we're in. Why a podcast for you? And why did you pick to choose, you know, what the topics and the things and the guests that you're talking about? Maybe just talk about your podcast in general.
Yeah. So honestly, it started as an idea. It was a different name altogether. We were doing 1 month one week Spanish, 1 week English. It started very chaotic, like most things that I've mentioned. And the initial idea was only so that I can, first of all, have conversations with people who were chefs and today working outside restaurant kitchens. So for me, in the beginning, it was a very selfish motive to get into these rooms, get to talk with people. And I said, might as well. I mean, if I need a reason for that, because I was having these mentoring calls with people who I know. I knew an R&D chef from Mugaritz who was starting her own consultancy business. And I said, you know what? I'm going to talk to her on a call myself. And I said, okay, there's so much value coming out of this call that I have luckily made the transition. I have found a company which headhunted me. They found me for the job. But maybe this could be of value for somebody else. So I said, you know what? I'm going to start. And that actually started with just like buying two mics. Actually, the mic I'm using now, 4 years later. So this mic, and I was using my iPhone. I'm still using my iPhone to record it. And a few subscriptions on Riverside, things like that. So the idea was just to kind of record conversations of people who have made transitions. And today, where we sit on how Fugitive Chefs has grown in the past, I think in this past year, it has grown the most, is the format has changed a little bit. So we are doing just English right now, but we are kind of getting into more specific parts. So for example, we had Dan Giusti. Dan Giusti was the head chef of Noma and today runs a company called Brigade, which puts chefs inside schools. So these were not the kind of episodes I was doing in the beginning. But I have Johnny Drain, who started the fermentation lab at Noma. and today is running two full-fledged companies, running one of the chocolate alternative companies in the UK. We have people like, most recently, we have Justin Khanna. He was working in restaurants like the French Laundry. And today he's running a program of coaching how chefs can still stay in restaurants, but use methods or use his systems where they feel the growth that the restaurant doesn't compensate. We had people like Jade Gross. She was working as a head chef at Mugaritz, goes for a trip to a wine field and says, you know, this couple is retiring from wine business altogether. She said, I know how to design food recipes. How different can it be to create wine? And today she has a massive vineyard in Rioja, sells bottles. So it's careers of people to just navigate that. Whenever a chef has a question, that whenever somebody working in kitchens has a question, that, you know what, I'm not growing over here. I don't see myself being a chef anymore. Or possibly for many of them, this happens when they are starting a family or some dynamic around their daily routine is changing and they feel that this version of being a chef doesn't fit. What I do not want people to do is that think that this is like the only way to be a chef, as we discussed before, to open these pathways that you can still be a chef and you can still be Pat Clifford, who's in the podcast, who said to me in the episode that 1 million people open a Lay's packet every day. And he's the principal R&D of PepsiCo, designing these recipes, doing this collaboration, searching for texture, searching for what the Gen Z consumer who's traveling on a train and not eating chips the way we used to eat wants in his chip today or in her chip today. So I feel I wanted to highlight these roles. And apart from the podcast, what we have recently started is a community, because one thing is I can show you stories. I mean, that is the easy part. I mean, even though it's a lot of, none of this monetary, it's a lot of investment of my time, resources, of course, subscriptions and gadgets. But the other side is I can show you, you can aspire, but you can still feel burnt out because you're like, okay, these guys have done it. I can't do it. And I do not know why. So I started the other layer, which is a community where we meet once a month. We have a WhatsApp group. It's pretty no frills right now. And we just discuss questions people have. Sometimes they want to have a 30-minute chat. Sometimes we connect them between the people in the community that, okay, this guy is doing so and so. He found this career, but he has a master's on his side. The other one doesn't have a master's on their side. So you know what? When you pay a 12,000 euro master's, they give you all these kind of resources and documents and Excels and PDFs. It takes you nothing to just pass on something specific to somebody else who can't afford that master, but wants to know specifically how do enzymes work, for example. So that's how Fugitive Chefs is right now.
I love it. With that group, what's the single biggest mental block or fear you see chefs struggle with when they decide to leave the restaurant kitchen?
So lately I'm seeing, and yeah, because I was inside Basque Culinary Center. So for those who don't know, Basque Culinary Center is famous as a culinary school, but I was working on the R&D side, which is a different entity altogether. It's called GOE, Gastronomy Open Ecosystem. And luckily, being inside as an R&D chef, I did not give lessons to school, means to the students very, very once in a while. I could see the education side of things from the inside. And then from the community side of things, I have a lot of listeners who are mostly young chefs. And the biggest frustration I see, or the biggest problem they have right now, is specifically with culinary education. I feel a lot of them are signing up for... early on, they realize they don't want to be chefs. So maybe you and I get into kitchens. In my case, I got into kitchens. And then later I realized, okay, this doesn't fit the kind of... what I can contribute, or my skill set doesn't really complement well with just being in a restaurant. But for many of the younger folks right now coming out of schools, what's happening is most schools are selling an idea of being a chef, which is still very unidirectional, is still going into restaurants. But a lot of them then sign up to courses which show them that you can be head of R&D in a company, or you can start your own you can be an entrepreneur into the food system. But the problem that I'm seeing most of these community members is that they have a very strong course. The material these schools are teaching is good. Some of the times it's outdated. The problem is because, again, schools make a curriculum, then they employ teachers to teach them, but they miss this loop of feeding them back. So feeding back what is changing, because it's a very fast-paced environment. And the second drawback I see is a lot of them feel like now they have the skill set, but there's no accompaniment into like finding a job or finding to enter these jobs, or how should they approach these companies. Like, as you said, do I feel nervousness when I say I'm going to a job and I don't have a food science degree? I think it's all about how you frame yourself as well. So the schools are not giving them this kind of, I don't know how to present themselves or how to go into these conversations of interviews and not highlight so much of what they not have, but highlight what they have. So I feel a lot of gap in this, between people wanting something, the education system selling them something, and then they realizing, okay, there's no way I'm getting what they sold me. But now I have this piece of paper which says I'm a master in food science or whatever that is. But how do I now sell myself? I feel that's where the massive gap is.
Oh, you totally hit it. I felt the same thing when I went to culinary school. It was that linear path. It's either go fine dining, go hotel, go catering. And I don't think that's what I want to do. You know, I didn't really know, you know, when I got into the industry. But to your point, how do you position yourself? Because many of the roles that I've had, to your point, on paper, mm-hmm. not qualified, not even yeah. close, shouldn't even be remotely near what you do. But it's about those ancillary skills. How are your people skills? How are your management skills? How are your leadership skills? The things that they can be taught to a degree. I think some people have some of those things just intuitively in them, right? Certain traits that you have. And it is a hard way of how do we, you know, we have these platforms. How do we continue to bridge the gap so people, chefs, not even just people who want to do the cooking side, because mm-hmm. I have a lot of people and a lot of things that I like to show on this podcast is, you know, there's 1,000 ways to go, right? You can work for an equipment manufacturer. You can be an author. You can be a dietitian. So there's a lot of routes, and I want to be able to explain and show that it's not just a linear path of, okay, go into a restaurant, do your time, put in the work, become a chef, and then you're going to figure it all out, because you're not at the end of the day. You learn through the process of doing. But I guess my ultimate question comes back to then is, for those that are thinking about getting into food, mm-hmm. you have to start somewhere.
Yeah.
Do they just go work in a kitchen? Do they do the internships that are shorter periods of time so they can get a glimpse of what a piece of industry would be? And how do they then present themselves to, even if they have nothing, they're 20 years old, mm-hmm. never worked in a kitchen, never done anything with food, but they feel like that's the route they want to go. Where do they even start?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I have a massive chunk of people who kind of have worked in restaurants, but again, to your question of people who have not done anything. First of all, what is your exposure? So I think if somebody who's not done anything would not have that much of an exposure to, say, food R&D, but maybe you're somebody who's seeing the rise of, I don't know, the softwares the restaurants is using today. You have a POS software for reservations. You have things like Airtable, CoverTable, all these things. So maybe that's your exposure. Maybe you're somebody who's interested in technology of some sorts and you want to work in food because you feel like you understand that world and you like the environment where this is. So I feel if you're a fresh slate and if you've not gone through any degree and if you've not even stepped into a kitchen, I would say it's a lot about where I am helping people right now is knowing that they're not alone. So I feel that is the first factor. I think you said about like, how do people sell themselves? How do they go this and that? I feel a lot of that can be worked upon. So I am working with people on like mentoring them, coaching them. And this is again, all free of cost, just because I feel that people who are like, I had a call 2 days ago with a guy from Lyon who was in Paul Bocuse restaurant as a commis, and he's been there in the same role for 6 years and he doesn't see growth. So for me, giving mentoring to this person, I cannot principally, having been in a similar situation, I can't attach money to it. So right now I'm doing it in a very personal way, because I feel what I've seen with a lot of conversations with people is that, and I've seen this with two of the cases last month who found an R&D job. One of them works in an Ibarra, which is a sauce company, and the other one is working for Euro Pastry, which is a frozen pastry company. And both of them, the only calls I had with them were about confirming to them that what they want is not incorrect, first of all. Because a lot of the people you look upon to as coming out of culinary schools are people who've had it very difficult, who've stayed many years in kitchens. So their first advice to you will be, it is supposed to be like this. It is wrong to want to pivot at 21. It's wrong to want to not work in kitchens, but work in food at 20. So first confirmation I give them is, whatever you want, it's not wrong. So if you want to say, you looked at Anthony Bourdain and your dream can sound very flimsy, that, okay, I want to travel and cook. Well, there's nothing wrong with it. Like, why do you have to go through the abuse Anthony Bourdain went through and write 2 books and write a column in New York Times and then you get the Paths Unknown gig and then you get no reservations? Because that was his path. But I feel like a lot of things I have done in my life have not gone through the classic. I did not say stay 4 years in Noma to be able to say, okay, I've been in Noma, I know exactly the ins and outs of it, and now it's a credible experience. I feel if you are directioning your energy right and if you correctly, you know where you want to get, I feel that is the bigger part. And the second part that accompanies and makes this transition easier is knowing you're not alone. So first of all, confirming whoever I have this conversation with, that what you're wanting is correct. There's no problem with it, but you'll have to, of course, work maybe harder if you don't want to spend 20 years in kitchen. How do you boil that operational reality down? Maybe you want to build a software about how can a kitchen work smoother with new laws that chefs can only work 8 hours? Because in Europe, you have a punch-in, punch-out system now. Restaurants are struggling with it. So you would say logically that if you want to develop a software solution for it, you have to be inside restaurant for 10 years and only then you will relate with the realities of an owner, of a chef. But why? If you're 20 and you have not studied food, if you've not studied anything, you could be somebody who has an aptitude for business and numbers. You get into it, put the extra hours, take enough interviews of people with 20 years experience, multiply that by 100, you have a 2,000 year of experience, and you can boil that down into software if you have the interest for it. So for me, the biggest cue to anybody who's starting off is having a clear vision of what you want. That can be completely wrong. It can completely change in a year. But being very honest to yourself, what is it that you want? Because a lot of times we are masking this with like, I feel like you're not telling yourself you want to travel and eat like Anthony Bourdain did, but you're telling yourself, oh, I want to work in the most pressured, most abusive kitchen, because you're kind of trapping yourself into the identity of Anthony Bourdain at 21 rather than what you want at 21. And I feel that's where this identity and a career, which is something very, which should be something very practical. You do a certain amount of hours, you get a certain amount of money. I do not confuse these two things. You can have an identity crisis with yourself, but do not bring that into your career. If your career goals are you want to next year, by the end of next year, make so much amount of money, and this is where your interest lies, make those two things match. Do not clash yourself with, okay, I cannot pivot into doing something more technical because technology is what's paying right now and the AI is having a boom. But I don't want to be one of those geeks, even though I have an aptitude for it. I want to belong more to the cult of being a chef who's working 18 hours a day, because that's never going to fulfill the dream and the vision that you have for yourself. But again, that's my opinion and that's what's worked for me. I've never told myself I have to do something because somebody else did it. I have more been this person who would rather question why was it that done. And I would go completely the opposite way, because I feel the only way you can stand out and you can do something different is by not following people who've done certain things.
Hmm. What's the 8-hour punch-in, punch-out thing in Europe? I have not heard of that.
So what's happening right now is like already when I was working in Mugger, this was 2021, there was already like a 3-year leeway period because people, I mean, the industry, the government knows that there is no way chefs and restaurants, especially if you're a restaurant owner, how do you force a restaurant owner to punch in, punch out when they are running a business? I mean, nobody in their right mind, if they own the business, do it. But what Europe and the law itself is trying to do is more and more restaurants, especially the ones at fine dining where the eyes are even more and they're under a magnifying glass, there is a punch in, punch out system. So just like at my work at Kraft Heinz, I enter with a card and I leave with a card. There's a complete log of how many hours I've worked. Same with Basque Culinary Center. Now restaurants are starting to have this place. So I have chat with people with people who are mentoring, and some of them tell me that yes, in France, for example, you have to check in, check out once you start your shift and end your shift. But there are people who are being told to, okay, now it's already 8 hours, go check out. But you can go upstairs. The restaurant is like a house. You can do these extra jobs upstairs. So there are still people who are trying to find these loopholes in the system. But the system itself is improving. The governments are improving. Labor laws are getting tightened. Spain right now is a 37.5 hours work system, not even a 40-hour week work system. So I feel these things are changing. But again, the consumer who's going to a restaurant wants to sit there and have their drink and stay until 1 and force the restaurant to push them out. So how do you mix these two realities? And that's where I see, I mean, just an idea that I made up with you is an idea. Maybe somebody who puts, as the system prepares restaurants for the system that's coming, or like the food waste law came up this year, where you'll be taxed for the amount of food you throw in your bins as food companies. So there are people who have been, since 5 years, I'm seeing these people I'm consulting with Basque Culinary Center, who are preparing softwares and preparing calculations. There are softwares today where there's a camera which can scan exactly what's going in your bin and kind of reduce the amount of plate waste. Say if like 10% of your food always comes back is because you're serving a massive portion, if you're already always throwing orange peels, for example, you should make this on the menu. So there are people creating these softwares and systems using a lot of AI, of course, which are kind of hoping and seeing, because through EU laws and through government laws, you already have the 4 or 5 year of period. So they create these technologies so that when the problem comes, when the fines are imposed, the restaurants already have a system which is plug and play, and you're leading in the market yourself. So I feel things like this, for somebody who's young and wants to work with food, there is so much room to do things. Honestly, I see examples every day with like the whole microalgae, with seaweed, with climate change, carbon emissions. There's so much happening right now that the whole supply chain. There's so many kind of these insertion points where you can work in the food system and you don't have to necessarily be a chef. And of course, if you're a chef, if you're somebody who's been 30 years in the business, you have even more value to put yourself together with somebody who's passionate to build these things, and you can put these two and two together on the table.
Yeah. Do you, just sticking on that topic, do you think, like, when you're working in a kitchen, like, any other industry, if you hear about it, like 6 hours, right? And usually you're fried. You can really get like six productive hours out of somebody, and the rest of it ends up being filler. If you put in 10 hours, 12 hours, do you think as someone in a kitchen that it's valuable that they put in a long day to understand what that hard work is? Is that just a stigma that we've put in the restaurant and it's the easiest way to not have to hire more people? Of like, hey, if I have X amount of people and they work really good, I can get more out of that one person for, you know, 12 hours than if I were to hire somebody else. What are your general thoughts on just those long hours in the kitchen?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think why it should be that difficult. I see no reason why. I mean, I feel like a lot of restaurants, actually most of the modern restaurants, which are trying to say, there are examples of restaurants who wants to be the most sustainable and they want to have, they're always aiming for things that the consumer is looking, or these Michelin guides and these awards are looking for. So say a restaurant wants to be sustainable, rather than understanding how the waste system works, for example, how composting works, they would put the staff to use that, the squeezed almond milk pulp to create an ice cream and put 6 hours more in, rather than understanding how composting works and let them go home. So I feel that if you're a restaurant, it should be like any other business. Every business has to apply the law. Every business has to finish certain amount of hours. Every business has to show numbers. I really do not understand why a restaurant cannot do that. Of course, I say this, I do not understand, but of course I know how the business is, how the margins are. But I feel we have to be a little more brave. I think we have stayed very much under the umbrella that the consumer is always right. I feel that is changing a lot. I feel COVID has shown us that when somebody imposes something on you, that in Barcelona, for example, the restaurant had to shut at 9:30, had to have six tables, everything somehow started falling in place. And post-COVID is what many restaurants are suffering now, because now the daily worker has realized that the system can work without me going. And of course, there was economic damages and economic problems. Many restaurants shut. But I feel the most creative place for me, if I would see one right now, would be one where everybody works the hours they're supposed to work. The owner himself or herself also works the hours they're supposed to work. And I feel there are a lot of formats which respect that. Of course, there are formats which are also respecting that, but creating this kind of, there are ghost kitchens, dark kitchens, which is only doing delivery models. So of course, there are ways that you can still work in food. You can still serve good food and work this way. I know of great supper clubs. I know of great private caterings. Mm-hmm. Open three. I mean, back in 2018, when I worked for Lastrans with Pascal Barbeau, I asked him, like, Pascal Barbeau works, it's a 3-Michelin-star restaurant with 20 covers, and he shut Friday, Saturday, Sunday. We used to work our asses off, but just Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And he said, I'm at a place which nobody, I mean, not everyone can afford to say that, but he said that if you want to come to eat for me, I'm a 20s cover restaurant, you will take holiday to come eat for me. You will not want to come to eat at my place on your day off. So I feel there are those extreme models where you create a product that people will make space for. Or the other extreme is things like dark, I mean, these dark dining and the whole ghost kitchens and delivery models, where you can create a very profitable business, but with respecting the hours. I think the disrespect only happens because we have this room for disrespect. Because we will not, I don't know, you will not do something stupid. If there's a law that you have to have a fire safety clearance, nobody will say, no, I'm going to make restaurants which does not have fire safety clearance. Why can't we have the 8-hour shift or human hours, the right pay and respecting the standards as the basic? I think if you start from that basic, we will question the other things and not question why the younger staff is complaining, why the younger staff doesn't want to work the extra hours. Because we have done it, because we've gotten used to this abusing, why does all the cost have to come down the staff side? Why can't this cost transfer itself to the consumer side, maybe to the purveyor side? There are many ways, the government, taxes, there are many things you can shift and change and push for, rather than pushing your own staff who's making this restaurant exist.
Yeah, it always does feel like it's the restaurant and the end up eating all the extra costs when you see a lot of these companies and their profit margins and you see what's coming out and you're just like, holy shit, like how you made X amount of billions of dollars. You couldn't take a a $100 million hit and then make things more affordable than the end consumer, because it's more affordable for the consumer. They're going to buy more. They're going to eat more. And that's what I don't understand is the amount of money that is made on that top level. It's just hard to wrap my head around when you see some of those figures and those numbers and why it can't be passed down to the restaurant versus the restaurant always being getting crapped on.
I mean, there are those cases. Of course, there are those cases which are like abusing this, which have become more like this VC model of people funding a restaurant. There are like massive VCs and private fundings behind the big names. And that's where this problem is happening, what you're highlighting. But also many like, I wouldn't say like mom and pop establishments, but these chain restaurants. So the restaurants which are like a four restaurant establishment, which has an HR, which has a company behind it. Many of the times it is because they know that this side of the business can be abused. They are really not spending time on optimizing the part that has to be fixed. Maybe it's the way you are ordering. Maybe it's the way you are purchasing things. Maybe you have not thought about the amount of HR personnel you have. Maybe you haven't thought about, maybe you do not need that property in that buzzy neighborhood. Or how can you make your menu more inclusive? How can you make changes where people want to come in to eat on a Tuesday? Maybe you have to do things which includes a lot more dietaries. Maybe there's more room for the new kind of diner which is growing. So I think it's just because it's so easy to abuse and so easy to normalize that a staff has to like literally go clock out and come back to work, which is completely illegal. But that illegal part feels so normal that everything else where we should focus on how to, like all these companies spending like marketing budgets now, every restaurant has a massive PR budget these days. Will they go to Instagram and say, okay, promote my video for €5 lesser or do something? Well, you do not make those bargains, right? Like in India, for example, I tell my mother this thing, like now after living back, like it's a thing with a lot of Indian kids, I think, or countries, I think Southeast Asia, where you can still bargain on the street. You will not go to a Zara and say, okay, make this t-shirt cheaper. But the street vendor who's selling vegetables and feeding his family with that, you want to bargain with that guy. And I think that's the kind of problem we are having in restaurants. Like, why are we not bargaining with the right people, the governments, the lawmakers, these purveyors, the multinational companies, your electricity provider? I mean, there are many ways you can save money and cost cut or increase your revenue by using technology, rather than abusing the same staff who is being abused. And there's such less. Everybody's complaining there's not enough talent. Everybody's complaining nobody wants to work in kitchen. But are we questioning why is this happening? And how are we trying to win these people back?
Yeah, what are your thoughts on tech in the kitchen? You brought it up in general. You know, I feel like that's kind of the way the things are moving in order to bridge some of these gaps. When you hear there isn't talent, there aren't enough people, we've got to bridge the gap somehow. So what are your overall thoughts on tech in the kitchen?
No, 100%. I mean, the last work I did with Boston County Center, we had a digital lab. So we had a running kitchen where we tested a lot of technology, which is why I know. So I worked with from basic things like an oven provider to creating patented objects where you can have maybe decrease some steps and processes of a restaurant, and to something more technological where it's like you have an AI, say like an Alexa inside a kitchen where your hands are greasy, or these small problems where your hands are greasy, the oven is ringing, who opens the oven? So things like this, optimizing those. So there are those things, but I think none of them I felt at any point are replacing people, because a lot of people ask me this question that will tech take over our jobs of being a chef? I feel if it's going to happen, we are going to be the last ones. And meanwhile, that doesn't happen. It is definitely making our job easier because I don't know, as a food, like, let me go from the food company side of things, to say, make with the climate change happening and tomatoes changing every year, technically a company making ketchup would make like 2000 runs of recipes to make these little bit salt, little bit vinegar, a little bit more sugar, because you have to make that run to taste the product. But today with AI and technologies, you can run these statistics and what an ideal ketchup should look like, what you're aiming for, and just do two tests instead of 2000. So that's where on food system level, these things are happening. This precision fermentation, looking for new sources of protein, working with the whole cell-based agriculture. So that's where the high technology is happening at food systems. But in restaurant level, just from the podcast, I've interviewed enough people. Like one of them, Dylan, for example, is making a software which is helping people with allergens. So there's a problem with people have allergens or dietary needs, or even if it's intolerances, they don't go to dine at a certain restaurant because they don't have the trust that maybe these guys won't cater to me well. Or even if the menu says it's right, maybe the chef inside, because it's something so human, maybe the chef is not respecting, and maybe instead of like gluten-free soy sauce, they're putting like a normal soy sauce. So what he has done with the software has removed the trust issue. So what the consumer is doing is they have an app, the app they trust as recommending them the right restaurants. And on the other side of the back end of this app, The chef has the same app as well to tell them what exactly they have to do to be able to accommodate on their technically same menu. How can they accommodate more diners? Mm-hmm. Because once you lose an allergen or a person who has like a celiac or somebody who has gluten intolerance, you don't only lose that consumer, but you're using a whole group. Maybe if they're celebrating their birthday or a girl's night out, you're losing a whole group of people. And that's a massive chunk, you know? So it's technologies like these which are not literally helping you create faster, but they are helping build this trust, I would say. So reservation, all the whole reservation manuals, we were building an app which could help you program. So a lot of, as you said, the cost problems, you know, like you're a seafood restaurant or you buy certain things, say programmed, you buy in October the chunk for the... So we have creating an application where you could, based on historical data, based on how a lot of factors are happening, how currently the war is happening, so things like this which could change prices of things, how could we somehow predict what sort of consumers will end up in your restaurant this year for Christmas? So like 8 months in advance, what will they order? What's going to be trending at that point? So is there a new Dubai chocolate going to drop, which is going to be suddenly everybody's going to add pistachios? So things like this. So programming, forecasting, future telling with technologically forward models. And I think that's the few of the, I would say, the most leading. Because I think the technically making a better oven, I think your listeners already know about. There's a lot of things happening with like oven providers, fridge providers. There's fridges which can program your purchases. So things like that, of course, you see more of. But I wanted to mention examples of things maybe you're not seeing so much of, because the idea of the technology is that it's like this human in the loop. There is a human who's controlling the loop, but it's still very human-led. But there are technologies which are using this human intellect to multiply themselves and be present at more places.
Chefs, don't worry. You're still needed. Somebody's still got to cook food.
For
and
now.
To your point. For now. But even then, you brought up tomatoes, different acidity mm-hmm. in the soil, the growing seasons, how yep. the weather affects the crop. The same thing is in a kitchen. There's different humidity levels. There's different things going on. So you still have to make adjustments, even if the recipe is the same. You still have to make micro changes on the fly based upon what is going on. And I don't think, in my opinion right now, I don't think AI and robotics is there. I don't think it would take a lot of information to process instantly to know, okay, I need to change this one dish to do this.
Yeah, that's very true, because I'm actually, to your listeners, to comfort them even further, I would like to say that a few months ago, I think this was October last year, I was on a table together. We were running this opening of a new center we built in San Sebastian with the top chefs you can think of, from Gaston Acurio to the Rocas brothers and stuff. And they were discussing of the paradigm of 10 years of culinary education, what that could be like. And one thing that they mentioned, which could be, I very much believe that could be true, is that as the world is changing, as the amount of AI news changing every week, there's new news coming out of new moments where we do not need humans. So you have, in the States, you have Waymo and things like that, where you don't need the most extreme things, like a cab driver. You think who could replace a cab driver is being replaced. And they actually mentioned very interestingly that maybe it's a very hopeful scenario, but it could happen that restaurants or food scenarios or catering institutions or school meals end up being the only places we have human interaction. So it won't be that they will replace us, but actually, because everything else is being replaced, and how personalized food is, as you mentioned, how personalized likings are, that we might be ending up being the only source of human interaction for the human race. That people go to restaurants, maybe it becomes less affordable. It already is very less affordable for many, many people in the society. But I think it becomes one of the few places where you can still have a human touch, still have somebody serving you, and the service and hospitality grows even further. That's what I hope. I hope it doesn't become too exclusive, but I really hope that people, rather than going down on techniques and going down on purchasing new equipments and creating more foams and bubbles floating in the air in restaurants, they like double down on the humanness, double down on really investing in staff who is happy and who's happy to treat their patrons and people who come to the restaurant as fellow humans and transfer this human energy. Because we have to conserve that, and we have a very intimate business where you get to, it's the only thing apart from pharmaceuticals that a human puts inside their body. And I think it's something to be respected upon.
Looking at food tech startups, alternative food ingredients, where do you see the biggest untapped opportunity for transitioning chefs to make a massive impact over the next 5 years?
I would say the number one, which I tell everybody, which doesn't need, it's like a no-brainer, you don't need to know the technology, is application. I feel a lot of these food companies, having traveled, like I go 3 times a year to Japan just to see what is emerging for Japan, for example. Japanese food companies are very good at creating products. They have a very still untapped technology. We think we know a lot about fermentation. They have so much that they have done for ages and years without using meat, for example. And a lot of these meat replacements are coming from Japan right now because they had techniques which was being used when they were using the temple cuisine or the food which did not require, you could not eat animal products. And they had these techniques before and now they're bringing it back. But the biggest skill I see a chef can bring on the table, first of all, if you are from the large majority of English speaker or Spanish speaker, whatever language you speak, you break the language barrier. So you make them more accessible to more people. But again, a sales rep showing food products or food technology or ovens is never going to have the same impression. Maybe they could give more numbers. Maybe they could talk to a general manager that so many ovens in your hotel would optimize it. But the real chef-to-chef connect is only a chef or somebody who's worked in food can do. So I would say application is the big way. So one is representing food companies. So being the corporate chef or business development or business unit chefs. And the second application, I would go even further that many of these food companies or technology and new products go to these massive food fairs and all they have is a stand which has a product. You have a pamphlet about it and that's all. And everybody going through the rounds is like, how do you stick out? Because you're showing me a product. You're saying it tastes so-and-so. It does so-and-so. It maybe is a thickener. Sometimes it's not even product. So if you're selling, say, a block of no meat products, it's easy. You can cube that up, fry it, and give it out to taste. And that maybe a salesperson can do or the food company can do. But many of these products that are coming out are possibly egg replacements to emulsify something better or something that makes a better shine in a croissant when you break it. So these things, I feel a chef doesn't even need a food science degree. The moment you see products like this and the moment you hear the pitch of the company that they want to, this is what they want to achieve or this is the market they're going to, I think we are very good on the feet coming up with solutions because we do that in restaurants. When a pregnant lady walks in and I have oyster on the menu, I have to come up with something because this was not announced and I have come up with a solution for the so the whole team doesn't go down. So I feel if we bring that learning, just to give you one example, so everybody focuses just on one example to approach when you want to write this letter to a food company, tell them, where are you going next? Which fairs are you going to next? What are you presenting? And for no cost, let me tell you, how would I present it? And believe me, they cannot take your recipes. They cannot replicate what you want to. Maybe they give the job to some other chef, which is great for the trade at large. But most likely they will come back to you and say, you know what? This sounds cool. You live in the city where we are going to go next month. Let's do this together and we'll see how that goes from there. I feel that's the best entry point a chef can have inside a food company to just boast about how food friendly you are, even though you're not very tech friendly. You don't know too much about the science behind the product, but be the presenters of those products.
I like that. I like that a lot. What kind of finishing up, what's kind of your biggest overall advice you could give to somebody, young culinarian, not necessarily that they're going to go into R&D, but just overall people who want to get into food because they're passionate about whether it's the people, actual cooking, any piece of this industry, what advice do you give them?
I would say, first of all, like as I said in the beginning as well, like I think trying to be sincere with yourself goes really a long way. It feels like, because most of the people I speak to, and it's also not just with people I'm mentoring in the community, but also with the guests who are like people who have transitioned years ago and today they are where they are and they're heading food companies or pitching startups to VCs. I feel a lot of them, what they've mentioned to me as well is that being sincere with yourself, knowing exactly what is that makes you happy. And if it's money, it's completely fine. If it's growing a product, it's completely fine. It's completely fine what makes you happy. But I feel as long as you keep lying to yourself that my identity is being a chef, I have read so-and-so book, I have seen so-and-so mentor, I had so-and-so teacher who said I can be nothing, so I'm going to prove him wrong or her wrong, and I'm going to be in the worst environments to come out better out of them. I feel this is not the way to go. I think we've been sold this model through movies, series, The Bear, things like that. We've been sold a model where if you go into abusive environments, if you go into things you do not like, you'll end up coming out stronger. I think that's true for some people, it can be true as well. But do you want that? Because I know enough examples who've not come out of good out of that. And they've left food altogether, gone far from this industry just because of how they were treated. So I would say, based on the environment we are in right now, based on what we are seeing, I feel I could give you a lot of advices on like very specific, as you said, don't be focused on R&D. I could give you like everything is so personal and so there's such a niche of like getting into this pivot. But I think the umbrella advice that could help everybody is being very honest with yourself. Sit down with a piece of paper today. Say, what do you want at the end of this year? What do you want at the end of 2 years? What kind of a future you see for yourself? So if you're somebody who says, you know, I want to live next year in Europe, or I want to live in India, or I want to travel here or there, I want to have this kind of a family, I want to do this for my parents, for example, or I want to be proud of, I want to work in this category. Maybe you want to work in insect protein, whatever that is. However wild that reality is, or however wild that aspiration is, be very true to it. Do not think that my dream is so and so because it will let me go there. You know, there's this very famous story. I can't remember it correctly, but it's like it's a guy who lives on a farm, I think, and it's somebody who's coming from a massive MNC or a corporate. And they talk to each other. The guy on the farm is like, yeah, I wake up, I go to the farm, I work 4 hours, I go back and I spend the rest of the day with my family. And the corporate guy is like, yeah, I go in the morning, I work 20 hours and I want to make money and I want to have an early retirement at 40 and I want to do this and that. And he's like, okay, but at the end, what do you want? He's like, yeah, I want to spend a few hours with my family, work for 4 or 5 hours. And he's like, yeah, exactly what I'm doing. So I feel rather than selling yourself a version of where you want to get, try to figure out if what you want to get, at least a smaller version of it, or the version of it that you want right now, immediately for you, should be very familiar with the version of it that makes you happy at the end. It cannot be that unfamiliar and that mismatch. And I do not know who has somehow convinced you that going through the wrong paths is going to get you the right place. It makes completely no sense. And it comforts to hear. I know for myself, and I heard this, somebody told this to me, it comforted me. So I hope it comforts people listening that wanting what you want is not wrong. But telling yourself you want something else is definitely unfair to yourself.
Wow. Yeah. You have to enjoy the journey.
Yeah.
You know, when you think that you just hit the end, because a lot of people, when you achieve the goal, you realize it's not everything that you thought it was going to be. So if the whole journey sucked the entire way,
exactly,
you're gonna look back and be like, oh, like I did all that for this, versus maybe you get to the goal, but the whole journey there was up and down, but you enjoyed the ride. Then you can look back and say, okay, well, it might, like to your point, the journey matched the goal more so than I did the whole journey just to get to the goal, but they were so far apart that now that I've hit my goal, I'm not happy. I'm not who I want to be. This isn't what I actually wanted to achieve. So you're spot on. And I love that story. I'm going to look that story up.
Yeah, I think that you'll find a better version of it. And I feel like, just adding to what you said, I feel this journey can only be fun. And I feel that's one thing also. Like I've told a lot of people, because I still practice it, honestly. Just when I had this job offer from Kraft Heinz, I did it again. Every time I had options or choices in life, in terms of career specifically, but not just career, actually in general at life, doing anything, even if going out this evening or not, everything that, many a times, at least in my case, I've been very fortunate. I have like very good options. So the option, like for example, last year, the option was continue with Basque Culinary Center. It's going very well. I'm living in a beautiful city with the surf town, San Sebastian, or going to Kraft Heinz and other options that I was thinking for myself. I think I've never chosen, like I've never selected the best option, because it's never existed. It's always been like something could be good because of these reasons, but the other one also looks equally good for the other reasons, completely different, but it looks good. But honestly, like really honest, and something I apply to myself, I've always chosen the option which if I do not choose it, I'll regret the most. And that for me has been my North Star. If I do not take this option, it's always very clear. You always have like many motivations to go many directions, but you always have one clear option, which if you do not do, you'll regret the most. And you might go wrong, but at least you were in the driving seat and not being driven by somebody else in the car. So I feel that's the other thing I could add, that the journey can only be fun if you are on the driving seat and you're choosing consciously every step you're choosing. This is how I want it to look. If it goes wrong, completely fine, because you chose that. Own it up and pivot as soon as possible.
Yes, Chef, this has been a phenomenal conversation. Everybody, go check out the Fugitive Chefs podcast. I've been listening to some episodes. Phenomenal guests that give some really deep insight of guys that were knee-deep in fine dining that have come out on the other side. Everything from media companies to software to you name it. There's some really awesome guests that are on there. So I can't thank you enough for bringing that to light and really digging deep into that segment of the industry. So go follow the Fugitive Chef podcast. Give it a listen. I'll put all the other social links to where you can find Furqan everywhere. Any other parting words before we part ways today?
No, lovely. Thank you so much for the opportunity, Jeff. I feel that it's nice to have, because I'm always on the other side hosting these conversations. So it's also nice to sit with the fellow fugitive and check out. I know what goes with the podcast. So I think it's lovely the work you're doing. And thanks so much for inviting once again.
Awesome. If you like this episode, please support. Go to Apple, Spotify, rate, leave a review. It always helps out. And until next time, we'll catch you on the sunny side.